Welcome to the podcast component of ArmageddonLetters.com, a virtual time machine back to the moment when the world was nearly destroyed in late October of 1962. You can also follow us on Twitter at ArmageddonTweet. I'm Jim Blight.
And I'm Janet Lang. The Cuban Missile Crisis happened a century ago, and it was our closest brush with catastrophic nuclear war. We want to take you sort of behind the scenes and actually sort of beneath the surface of the Cuban Missile Crisis. We're going to get into our time machine now and try to transport you to August and September of 1962, about 1 to 2 months before the Cuban Missile Crisis erupts and shatters the security and safety of the entire world.
So it's the end of August, 1962. Nikita Khrushchev, the Soviet chairman, unquestioned leader of the Soviet Union, is cooling his heels down on the Black Sea at a place called Pitsunda. The deployment to Cuba has been going on since June or so. Both parties agreed to it, Cuba and the USSR.
Now, we should say there's this massive transfer of military arms from the Soviet Union to Cuba because the U.S. has been threatening Cuba. The year before, there was the abortive Bay of Pigs invasion that failed. The Cubans triumphed, but they figured it was just sort of a warm-up act for what would be coming. And there have been bellicose statements in the U.S. press where Republicans and many Democrats as well are badgering Kennedy that he really needs to be much more active against Cuba and maybe even invade Cuba. So the whole setting is one of tension if you're living in Cuba.
Oh, yeah, tension. It's an understatement. All this stuff is arriving, all of this equipment, all these Soviet personnel dressed in these weird-looking striped shirts and butch cuts, baggy pants, so as not to tip off the Americans that there are thousands of blonde, crew-cut, thick-necked Russians amongst the Cubans.
And it worked, actually.
Hey, the
CIA
funny thing
doesn't.
Is,
what's bizarre is it did work. The CIA actually doesn't pick up the massiveness of the number of Soviet troops that are there. Eventually, there'll be 43,000 troops, and the CIA estimated at the maximum maybe 5,000 to 6,000. So, bizarre as those costumes may be, they worked.
Well, they worked, sort of, but maybe we could just say a word here about the disguise, the deception, the failure to pick it up. First of all, I doubt that Nikita Khrushchev would have known this, but the summer is the hurricane season in the Caribbean. There's a lot of rain and a lot of cloud cover. The U.S. was only flying the really high-flying U-2s at 75 to 80,000 feet, and if there's cloud cover, they can't take pictures of what's on the ground. They can't see a thing. Moreover, individual people or even regiments of people are not that easy to pick up. But here's another thing. Reports were coming out of Cuba into Miami at the CIA station in Coral Gables. There were very accurate reports arriving that there were lots of Russians, lots of stuff, even that there were large missiles arriving on the island. Unfortunately, these reports were accompanied by other reports, which claimed, for example, Roger Hilsman mentions this in his memoir of the Cuban Missile Crisis, a State Department official, that the Russians were all 9 feet tall, had massive arms and legs, and possibly what we would call now, I suppose, androids or robots or something. Just completely outlandish reports, magnified every time it was told. And so it was a little tough to know whether you should believe these people on the ground in Cuba or not. Okay, so late August, Cubans are worried. Now, they're not worried, I think, in the sense of are the Americans going to attack or not. I mean, they had decided long before that the Americans were going to attack. They attacked the previous year. They're going to attack the subsequent year or whatever it takes to get their people all lined up the way Kennedy wants them. And then they're going to go for it and throw the Cuban regime out. Regime change was in the air. What they're really afraid of here is making fools of themselves, appearing to sort of cheat and deceive and lie. Khrushchev has no problem with cheating, deceiving, and lying. He grew up under Stalin. This is the way it is. You get away with what you can get away with. Fidel Castro is a lawyer, and he is extremely legalistic. He has a Jesuit background, as many of these people do, which is also a form of legalistic disputation. And so they're worried that the world opinion will not favor Cuba or the Soviet Union once it's discovered that it was done in secret, number one, and number two, possibly even more damning, that it was embedded in an entire framework of lies and denials. So they send the great Che Guevara, Ernesto Che Guevara, then the Minister of Industries, with Emilio Aragonés, who was the, one way to describe him was described to us by one of our colleagues as the Cuban smuggler-in-chief. He had a background in banking, and he knew a lot about currency, and he had gone to school in the United States and was busy accumulating cash for the Cuban Revolution. So the two of them go over, they go down to Pitsunda, down on the Black Sea, and they make one last effort to make Khrushchev see that lying and deceit is going to backfire, that when Kennedy and his people find out, as they will, that Kennedy will have all the grist for his mill that he needs to go in and totally destroy the Cuban Revolution. Now, the only chance, they think, is if Khrushchev will just stop what he's doing, come to Cuba, hold a press conference with Fidel Castro, and say, we're doing this. We're not finished. We're doing it. The Americans did it in Turkey. The Americans did it in Italy. The Americans did it in Britain, and so on and so on and so on. They have missiles at all these places pointing at us. We're going to do it honestly, and we're going to sign a treaty, and then that will be that. Now, Khrushchev listens to this argument. He's heard it before from the Cubans, and he really has to stifle laughter. Because in his view, if they were to go public at this point, that ensures that Kennedy's going to attack the island because they have to say, well, you know, we're not done yet, but we're getting there. And if they're not done, the missiles are not operational, Kennedy won't have any disincentive not to attack. And so you can't do it that way. They have a polite conversation, and Emilio and Che go back to the island and have to report to the maximum leader, Fidel Castro, that Khrushchev is unmovable on this issue and that therefore they should prepare for an explosion when Kennedy finds out.
Because they believe he will find out. Khrushchev is basically crossing his fingers,
yes,
and hoping that he'll be able to sort of do it all before the Americans officially discover the missiles. But the Cubans are worried that that actually will not be the case, that in fact the Americans will find out, and boy, oh boy, they'll be held to pay. Now, so this is part of what's going on. The other thing is that Kennedy's sort of in a pickle as well, because he doesn't really want to invade Cuba. He certainly would like Cuba to go away, but he doesn't really want to invade it. But there are lots of voices in the U.S. that see the buildup. They don't see a nuclear buildup, but they see a buildup, and they're very nervous, and they do want Kennedy to attack. So on September 4th, he's issued a statement in which, in his mind, he draws a line in the sand. Now, he had been told repeatedly at a number of different levels of private conversation, of channels that he trusted between the U.S. and the Soviet Union, that in fact the Soviets were not going to put in missiles in Cuba at all. They weren't going to put in nuclear missiles in Cuba. And so he feels, in a sense, somewhat confident, nervous but confident, saying, I'm drawing a line in the sand. Okay, we'll tolerate a lot of military machinery and so forth, but line in the sand is no nuclear weapons, and if they're there, quote, the gravest consequences would arise, i.e. we would take them out. So that's what's happened. Now, the deception continues. A few days after that, on September 7th, Anatoly Dobrynin, the Soviet ambassador to the U.S., has a conversation with Adlai Stevenson, the U.S. ambassador to the U.N., and says, not to worry, Adlai, only defensive weapons, no big deal, don't worry, don't get nervous about this. So this continues.
Of course, Dobrynin thought he was telling the truth. He's been lied to by his superiors.
Right.
It made him a hell of a good liar.
But the other thing that happens, and the Cubans and the Soviets certainly see this, is that that same day, September 7th, Kennedy goes to Congress, who has been essentially begging him to come to Congress and make this request. He makes a request for 150,000 reserve troops
called to active duty.
Right.
Yeah. The weekend warriors are going off to war.
So all of this is going on at the time. You then also have Raul Castro in Havana. So he gives a speech, and this is reported in the main newspaper in Havana, Revolucion. It's out there for any intelligence agency to take a look at. And I'm quoting now, "You've been warned, imperialists. If you are ready to die at your stations, go ahead. Go on with your provocations. Come with your aggression, an aggression that might, no, not might. We are sure we will be the last people ever to have suffered imperialist aggression. You have been warned, if you try, imperialism is finished." This is pretty unambiguous. The headline is, quote, "Let's hope that they will think without hubris."
First of all, there's no question of what he's threatening. He's threatening the total destruction of the United States if they happen to invade Cuba. Now, what is not clear is that will the total destruction of the United States originate from the island of Cuba? Is that what he's saying? Is he really trying to say, we have these missiles, or we almost have these missiles, or they're really they're coming online, so watch out, or...
What does he mean? Because one could say, well, maybe he's the mouse that roared.
No, but the other option is that the Soviets have made a commitment. We're under what in the West was called a nuclear umbrella, and so if you attack us, we don't necessarily need the missiles, because the Soviets have all these missiles all over their land, and they can reach the United States. So, you're going to have to suffer the consequences. Where the missiles and bombs come from doesn't matter, but they will destroy you if you mess with us, says Raul, who happens to be the president of Cuba today.
So all of this is going on, and basically, finally, Khrushchev decides that he needs to sort of put his hat in the ring and issue an official statement from the government of the Soviet Union in response to Kennedy's September 4th statement. It is a statement that is released by TASS, the Soviet news agency, and it is then reported and carried in the New York Times on September 11th, 1962. And by the way, it's reported, quote, "A U.S. attack on Cuba would mean nuclear war," unquote.
Yeah, that's fairly unambiguous. Toward the end of this TASS statement, it says, "The Soviet Union would like to draw attention to the fact that one cannot now attack Cuba and expect the aggressor will be free from punishment for this attack. If this attack is made, this will be the beginning of the unleashing of war." That is, between the United States and the Soviet Union, the two nuclear superpowers, he's saying, will go to war if the United States attacks Cuba and seeks to replace the regime.
Can you imagine this? You're in 1962. There are two enormous nuclear powers on Earth, and you have something like a headline that says a U.S. attack on Cuba would mean nuclear war. Not just your basic old war, nuclear war.
This is the cloud that we all lived under in those days. We were children and certainly didn't grasp all this, but the tension was daily. There was really no getting used to it, and every so often it would pop its ugly head from beneath the surface and stare right at you. The idea being that this country, which has never seen armed conflict since its civil war in the middle of the 19th century, this relatively peaceful and bucolic land, rich land, favored land, lucky land, that this could be nuclear toast within hours if the provocation was perceived a certain way, if the leaders didn't work things out, if no arrangement could be made that was acceptable with regard to Cuba for both the Soviet Union, the United States, and of course for the Cubans. And so you would go to bed at night after reading these things and thinking, if I take this seriously, there will be war. There will be nuclear war over Cuba. The question arises as to whether you're going to wake up the next morning or whether you're not.
Now, simultaneously with the threat, though, Khrushchev's statement of September 11th, 1962, also continues very explicitly the lies and the deception. The world doesn't know yet that they're lies and deception. Many people suspect it, but in about a month and change, everybody's going to know that they're lies and deception. For example, a quote from Khrushchev's statement. The armaments and military equipment sent to Cuba are designed exclusively for defensive purposes. Not the case. But then, just in a sense, again, to sort of put in, it's not exactly a little comforting piece of information, to keep the U.S. off track in what was actually going on in Cuba, Khrushchev also then says, and I will quote, "Our nuclear weapons are so powerful in their explosive force, and the Soviet Union has such powerful rockets to carry these nuclear weapons that there is no need to search for sites for them beyond the boundaries of the Soviet Union." Now, that statement actually made very good sense to everybody, because the Soviet Union had never put any nuclear weapons outside its own borders. So that was an easy one for people to believe. Unfortunately, turned out to be a lie.
Well, they earnestly in the U.S. wanted that to be true.
Some did.
Kennedy certainly was hoping, wishing that, oh my goodness, that all of this stuff going on in Cuba does not have as its concluding act a nuclear confrontation. I'm hoping, if I'm Kennedy, that Khrushchev draws a line short of that. I've done everything I can to let him know that the gravest consequences will arise, that we will not accept it, and we'll go into crisis mode after that, raising the risk of war between our nations and the destruction of the world. But I hope that he's serious when he says we have no need. In other words, implying that we're not doing that thing that you're worried about. Well, of course, he was. They were.
And so after the fact, this statement by Khrushchev, it's misleading, it's deceitful, and it's threatening.
Yeah.
Now that is a serious trifecta in terms of communication between two major leaders with a huge nuclear arsenal.
Yeah, that's a fine way to try to get along, isn't it?
So that's the world in September, early to mid-September of 1962. And basically, in terms of what's coming ahead, you haven't seen anything yet.
Yeah.
This is sort of the calm before the storm, as it were.
Right. This is the verbal stage. It'll get nasty very soon. Stay with us. That's it for this podcast. Visit us regularly for more in the podcast series, as well as news about our new book, short films, graphic novels, and blogs, yes, by our three leaders. And don't forget to visit us at facebook.com/ArmageddonLetters. I'm Jim Blight.
And I'm Janet Lang.